First of all, thank you everyone for taking the time today to join this webinar. We think the subject matter is of great importance. We're very excited at Concordia about this report that came out and the opportunity to be partnering with Stone Barns Center, Armonia, Bonterra Partners, and SLM Partners to discuss some of the findings. For those of you less familiar with Concordia, we're a nonprofit based in New York City, based on the belief that public-private partnerships provide a vehicle or an access road to achieve many of the social impact objectives that the world is striving towards. So how do we tackle big challenges around the world? It's our opinion that through cross-sector collaboration and public-private partnerships, we can have a more meaningful and lasting engagement opportunity. We have at the organization a campaign for a sustainable global food supply, wherein we talk about key themes such as animal welfare, environmental management, food, nutrition, access, and how partnerships can provide the vehicle to achieve all of those objectives. So this report that just was launched on the 19th by Stone Barns Center and its partners is very timely and relevant to this campaign and to the broader conversation that many of you joining us today are having. We'll be talking today about some of the challenges that were elicited in the report, as well as some of the opportunities where partnerships can provide a role. And before we launch into that conversation, just a bit of a technical explanation. First of all, this is the Zoom platform. If you're not familiar with it, it has both video and dial-in functionality. So however you're joining us today, we're just glad you're joining us. If you have any problems, please feel free to use the chat function on the right-hand side of the screen to ask a question about a technical feature or about the report later on, or send myself or my team an email if you have any challenges. But hopefully this is a technologically friendly platform for everyone. Everyone is joining on a mute function in order to reduce the background noise. That should not dissuade you from joining the conversation. We encourage the video, we encourage your contributing and engaging. And I know it's a little bit trickier with everyone joining remotely, but we find that this is a nice, easy way to have an important conversation. And so hopefully you all are all fully invested in the conversation and asking questions and thinking about how it applies to your own unique roles. This call will be recorded. It will be available on the Concordia website after the fact, so you can always go back and find that favorite quote that somebody issued or return to some piece of information that could advance your work. And I think we can get started. We'll have about 20, 25 minutes of presentation with regards to the report led by Renee and Paul. And then we'll move into a full Q&A and feel free to ask them of the participants, of the guests, or just raise your own experiences, because we know we have a lot of varied and fantastic expertise on this call. We're joined by the USDA, by independent farmers and cattle and rancher associations and alliances alike, nonprofits, NGOs, the advocacy community. So we have a lot of really important voices and perspectives on this call that we want to make sure we're getting to. With that, I'm so pleased to hand this off to Jill, Paul, and Renee, and I believe Renee will be leading the presentation. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Hannah. Good morning, everybody. Can you all hear me okay? Yeah, sounds like it's working fine. Perfect. So I'm going to share my screen with everyone. Let's see. Market study presentation. Let's see. Share screen. I just want to see if this is working properly. Does it look okay, Honan and Hillary? Perfect. Great, so thank you very much for the introduction. When we started doing this grass-fed beef market study last year, we first raised two key questions that we told ourselves that we wanted to find the answers to at the end of the report. Is grass-fed beef destined to remain a niche product for the affluent consumer? Or can it become a mainstream food that displaces conventional grain-finished feedlot beef? But first of all, why should consumers be eating and supporting grass-fed beef? Many of you probably know this already, but from a human health perspective, grass-fed beef has been shown to have much better and healthier omega-6 to omega-3 ratios, a much higher concentration of antioxidants and lower risk of E. coli infection and multi-drug resistant bacteria. And in terms of animal welfare, grass-fed animals that are raised on pasture, that are only fed grass and that are not confined are just much healthier animals. And as a result, little drug treatment is required. And from an environmental impact perspective, grain-finished feedlots are very often associated with problems of manure runoff and water and air pollution. And cattle has also been blamed for being huge emitters of greenhouse gases, especially methane. However, grass-based production systems that use regenerative grazing systems, and by that we mean holistic grazing, intensive rotational grazing, and adaptive multi-paddock grazing, these regenerative grazing methods can actually help restore soil health, pretty much eliminate the risk of soil erosion, and at the same time help sequester carbon, hence helping mitigate climate change. But most importantly, consumers really should be eating grass-fed beef because it has a better taste, flavor profile compared to grain-finished beef. Top chefs around the country now and also food writers and food connoisseurs are all coming to the consensus that high-quality grass-fed beef can be just as tasty, if not tastier, than grain-finished beef. So for all these different reasons, the demand for grass-fed beef in the US has been growing very quickly. Grass-fed beef sales at the retail level has been growing at roughly 100% per year for the last 5 years since 2012, which quickly outpaces other categories of beef such as organic beef or antibiotic-free beef and conventional beef. Having said that, grass-fed beef in the US is currently still just a very tiny part of the entire beef market. We estimate that roughly $4 billion, there was roughly $4 billion of grass-fed beef sales in the US in 2015, which is just roughly 4% of the entire beef market. The $4 billion can then be further divided into two categories, what we call labeled and unlabeled grass-fed beef. Labeled grass-fed beef refers to basically beef that are labeled with the word grass-fed, either on the food packaging or on a menu at restaurants. And that really just comprises $1 billion of the entire grass-fed beef market. On the other hand, the remaining 75% or $3 billion of the grass-fed beef market is actually comprised of unlabeled grass-fed beef, which is actually grass-fed beef, but it doesn't carry the grass-fed beef label and is usually of lower quality so that it's mixed in together with conventional beef and is being turned into, say, ground beef and hamburgers. And roughly 75 to 80% of the grass-fed beef that's being consumed in the US is actually imported from overseas countries such as Australia, New Zealand, and South American countries such as Uruguay and Argentina and Brazil. Going back to one of our key questions earlier, you know, can grass-fed beef become a mainstream product? We have identified four key challenges that has prevented the grass-fed beef industry in the US from scaling up. The first one is inconsistent or variable meat quality, followed by confused consumers. And the grass-fed beef industry has also suffered from an inefficient supply chain as well as very high production costs. And these last two factors have actually led to the consumer paying very high prices to buy grass-fed beef. But the thing is, all of these challenges can actually be addressed and solved. Looking at each of these challenges in a little bit more depth, the market and consumers, they expect to eat consistently high-quality beef year-round, whether it's grain-finished beef or grass-fed beef. But consistency is not something that the grass-fed beef industry in the US has been able to deliver. So consumers may buy a really high quality of grass-fed beef once at the supermarket, and they would go back, you know, 2 weeks later to buy the same product, and it turns out that it's a really bad piece of grass-fed meat. At the same time, most of the grass-fed beef producers in the US only harvest their animals once a year currently, and so they aren't able to offer fresh beef to the market year-round. But the truth is, high-quality grass-fed beef can be produced in the US year-round and is actually being done by a small group of producers in the US. But what needs to happen is for the rest of the grass-fed beef industry in the US to rise up to this level. Consumers are also very confused when they go beef shopping these days. They are faced with, or they have to grapple with, multiple production claims and marketing labels, and very often consumers just don't know which one is which. If you look at this slide at the bottom left quadrant of the matrix, conventional beef is what consumers find most often when they walk into a supermarket, obviously. And conventional beef in the US basically means is coming from animals that have been confined and they're finished on grains. And more often, consumers are now finding grass-fed beef, which is the top right quadrant you see in the matrix here. They're finding grass-fed beef being sold in the marketplace, and grass-fed beef means it's coming from animals that are raised on pasture and grass-finished. However, consumers then sometimes encounter labels such as pasture-raised, which basically refers to animals that are raised on pasture, but they're actually finished on grains, so they're not grass-fed. And there's also a growing segment of beef in the US that we have termed grass feedlot beef. And grass feedlot beef is currently labeled as grass-fed beef, but it actually refers to beef coming from animals that are confined in like a feedlot type of environment and are fed grass pellets. And so instead of, you know, the animals being out on pasture grazing and browsing, they actually have the feed brought to them in like a feedlot environment, which is very different from what consumers think of when they think of grass-fed beef. And there are other marketing labels that are out there to confuse consumers. You know, there's antibiotic-free beef, vegetarian-fed beef, organic beef, and natural beef. And sometimes consumers think some of these actually means grass-fed, but actually not all grass-fed beef is equal. And so how we define grass-fed beef actually really matters. So how does the market actually define grass-fed beef? The four grass-fed certification programs in the US, which are the first four listed in the table that you see there, each of these programs actually currently has their own definition and standard for what grass-fed beef should mean. And none of these four standards are particularly well known to consumers. And at the same time, the USDA, the US Department of Agriculture, also has its own definition of grass-fed, which is admittedly maybe a little bit too loose right now in terms of the definition. So what we need to see the industry do is for all these different organizations to get together and agree on a common set of principles that will set a minimum bar or a minimum baseline for what grass-fed beef should mean. And we also need to then go out there and educate consumers in terms of what grass-fed beef is and why they should consume grass-fed beef. But perhaps the biggest challenge for the grass-fed beef industry currently is that it is currently very expensive and unaffordable for many consumers. Grass-fed beef is currently priced at 71% premium to conventional beef, which is illustrated by the top blue line that you see in the graph here. And at that price range, it makes grass-fed beef even more expensive than other types of beef, such as organic beef and antibiotic-free beef. So why is grass-fed beef currently so much more expensive? And it partly has to do with a very inefficient supply chain. So if we look at the beef supply chain, if we try to trace a beef animal and look at how it goes from being a calf on a farm to end up being sold as beef at the retail store, we would see that the conventional beef supply chain, which is illustrated by the red graph that you see on the left, the conventional beef supply chain is actually more efficient, it's shorter, and actually have fewer intermediaries involved. So if we first look at the red graph, a beef animal in the conventional, it starts off its life, the beef animal starts off as a young calf on a cow-calf operator, and after that it's sold to a stocker operator, which feeds the animal a bit more grass, and then after that the animal is sold to a feedlot, which finishes the animal on grains. After that, the animal is then sold to a meat packer, which owns slaughter facilities or processing facilities to process the animal, and then the beef is sold to a distributor who would then sell the beef on to the retailer. But what has happened within the conventional beef industry is that after many years of consolidation and vertical integration, some of these meat packers, not only do they own some very large-scale processing facilities, some of them actually also own feedlot these days, and they also have their own distribution arms. And so actually conventional beef these days don't often have to pass through that many pairs of hands, as long as they go through the meat packer, which actually has accumulated huge economies of scale over the years, and they're dealing with large volumes. the meatpackers actually don't need to charge a very high margin on each unit of beef that they work with in order to make a bit of money because they're working with such big volumes. And this picture is very different from what we see on the grass-fed beef side, which is the green graph that you see on the right there. If we look at the grass-fed beef industry, the market is currently very fragmented. It's made up of many small players, and none of them really have accumulated any sort of huge economies of scale, and very few of them are actually vertically integrated. And so what happens is, for a grass-fed animal, it first begins its life just as on the conventional side, as a calf, on a cow-calf operator's farm. It is then sold to a stocker operator, which then feeds it more grass, and then the animal is sold to a grass-fed finisher, which finishes the animals on grass. The animal is then sent to a processor to be slaughtered, and these processors in the US to date that have been dealing with grass-fed beef animals are much smaller in scale. They may be just a very small private processor, or they could be a larger mid-sized processor, but regardless, the number of animals they slaughter per year is much fewer than what the conventional meat packers are dealing with. And so without any meaningful economy of scale, a lot of these processors simply have to charge a much higher processing fee to their clients in order to cover their own overhead and operational costs. The beef is then sold to like a branded program, which is basically a meat marketer, which again is not dealing with a huge volume of grass-fed beef today, and so they have to also charge a pretty high margin just to kind of make some money and stay in business, so to speak. And then the beef is sold to a distributor, which could be like a small specialty meat distributor, which is dealing with a small volume of premium beef, and they really do charge a very high margin on their cost of beef in order to sell the beef onto the retailer. So on the grass-fed beef supply chain side, basically, the beef needs to pass through many more pairs of hands, many more intermediaries are involved, and each of them charge a much higher margin compared to their conventional counterparts. And all of this inefficiency kind of help explain why grass-fed beef currently is suffering from much higher processing costs and distribution costs compared to conventional beef. The other thing in the report we also looked at is the key challenge of high production costs of grass-fed beef in the US. And we try to compare that with its competition. So we first look at the production cost of producing a head of grain-finished animal by a small U.S. feedlot in the U.S. And the metric that we use to measure that is actually cost of gain, which is the number that you see in the bottom row in the table there. The cost of gain refers to the total cost it takes the operator to put on an additional pound of weight on the animal. And in this case, in our analysis, for a small feedlot in the US, the cost of gain is 82 cents. And this number actually really fluctuates widely depending on that year's grain prices. But regardless, you can see that the profit margin is actually very low. If you look at the EBITDA margin line, which is the second to the last line in the table there, they're barely profitable. And in fact, feedlots are very, very often unprofitable. We then look at the production costs in Australia. How much does it cost for them to raise a grass-fed animal? And we look at Australia simply because that's the country that we import most of our grass-fed beef from in the US. And as you can see in Australia, the cost of gain is very, very low. And that primarily has to do with the fact that in Australia, they're blessed with favorable climatic conditions where grass can grow easily throughout the year. And at the same time, land is also more affordable in Australia so that people can actually do large-scale grass-fed beef operations much more easily. But it actually doesn't mean that grass-fed beef producers in the US cannot be profitable. And in fact, we have identified two ways in which they can do so. The first way is to actually sell your beef directly to consumers at very high premium. So with this direct marketing model, which is how most of the small-scale grass-fed beef producers are selling their beef, you can see that their cost of gain is actually very high because they don't have the scale. However, they're able to charge a high enough premium that they can still be slightly profitable. The other way for U.S. grass-fed beef producers to be profitable is not by selling at a very high premium, but to accumulate enough scale so that you can start to bring down your operational and overhead costs. And so in this case, we look at a grass-fed finisher that finishes roughly 4,000 head of animals a year, and they can just sell their grass-fed beef to a grass-fed branded program at roughly, say, 25 to 30% premium. but they can really start to bring down the cost so that overall they're still making a bit of a margin, a bit of a profit. But what does it really take to lower the production cost of grass-fed beef in the US? In the report, we constructed an aspirational case, an aspirational scenario where we say, what if we finish 10,000 head of animals a year? And this would be a very large scale grass finishing operation that also uses best practice in terms of cattle and land management practices, such as, you know, choosing the right cattle genetics and also using regenerative grazing methods to really lower your feed costs. If we do that, we can see that it's conceivable that the cost of gain can really come down significantly to roughly just $1 per pound. And that's mainly because if you're at a large scale, you start to really get the economies of scale and the overhead and operational costs on a per head animal basis. At $1 per head of cost of gain, that's really just roughly 20 to 30% higher than what the feedlot and what our analysis is showing for the feedlot model. And that's when we think that grass-fed beef production in the US can really start to become more competitive. So in summary, we think there are a few things the US grass-fed beef industry can do. First of all, it can focus on producing consistently high-quality, well-finished grass-fed beef year-round. It needs to develop stronger standards for grass-fed beef and also go out there with a nationwide brand-building consumer awareness campaign to educate consumers on why they should consume grass-fed beef, but more importantly, why they should be supporting U.S. ranchers who are using regenerative grazing methods to grow grass-fed beef. The industry should also pursue scale and aggregation to unlock supply chain efficiencies. If we can accumulate and aggregate enough volume, for example, if we can pull together 500 head of grass-fed animals per week, at that volume, you can start sending that to conventional meatpacker slaughterhouses and start to pay a lot less for your processing costs to slaughter the animals. And at the same time, if you accumulate enough volume, you can start to work with some of the conventional food distributors who charge a much lower margin to distribute the beef for you. And if we can combine that with establishing well-managed, scaled-up grass-fed finishing operations that use best cattle and land management practices to really lower grass-fed beef costs, that's when we think the consumers will start to see that grass-fed beef prices will come down for them so that it's more affordable for more consumers. And so I think if the grass-fed beef industry can strive to work towards, you know, the four recommendations that we have there and try to do all of the above, that's when grass-fed beef in the US can really start to take off so that it's no longer just a niche product, but then it can become a mainstream product for American consumers. So that's just a really quick run through of our report. And Paul and I and Jill, we are here to answer any questions that any of you may have.
And I thought I might just say a couple of words. This is Paul McMahon from Estelin Partners about what this sort of report does and doesn't cover. Kind of and what our starting point was, and maybe a little bit more about just who we are also. So, you know, Estelin Partners, we're an investment management firm. We focus on raising funds and investing funds in more ecological regenerative farming and forestry systems. And we currently manage a large Australian grass-fed beef cattle fund, but we now have an office in New York and investigating some opportunities in the US as well. And so our focus in this report, it was on the market dynamics and on the economics of grass-fed beef. We do synthesize some of the science around, you know, why we think people should be considering buying and eating grass-fed beef, but we don't claim to have come up with anything new there. That's more a synthesis of existing research. The bit that is new, I think, is the analysis of demand, of the supply chain, of some of the production economics as well. I think one thing we found when we started looking at this is that there's a real lack of information on this sector. The USDA does a fantastic job of covering conventional beef, and you can kind of pull out any statistic you want. But when you try and learn about grass-fed beef, there's very much scattered data, big holes. So it was quite an effort of the last 9 months to interview as many people as you could in the industry to try and pull together this sort of a fact base, you know, which hopefully people can use for decision making. I think, as Renee said, you know, our overall conclusion is there's definitely a huge potential for grass-fed beef. The demand is there. There are challenges, but we think they can be overcome through this combination of scale and aggregations and more efficiencies along the supply chain.
Hi, everyone. I'm Hillary. I'm from Concordia. Just like to say thank you both to Renee and Paul for that great overview of the report. So we know people probably have questions for you all and Jill as well. So right now we want to transition to some panelist Q&A time before moving on to a more open, diverse conversation among everyone on this call. I just want to remind everyone who maybe hopped on the call a little late, everyone is placed on mute. So if you'd like to speak, please unmute yourself before speaking. So I'll start off by asking you all a question about the end of the report. As for the aspirational model that you define in the conclusion section, what types of partnerships are needed to make this a reality?
Well, I think from my perspective, what's interesting, there's a number of groups already working on these kind of aspirational cases, one or two who may actually be on the call. So people, I think, have seen this opportunity and are putting together business models, looking to raise capital, and looking to invest in these scaled-up systems. So I think that's very encouraging. We already know four or five groups, you know, who are working in that direction. So you know, the collaboration is required. It's getting a few things right. It's getting access to land. It's getting access to capital. But I think maybe most importantly is getting access to the right kind of management and the kind of skilled management that's required to do this well. It's not easy, and the conventional beef sector may have lost, you know, some of the skills and knowledge that are necessary to produce, you know, high quality grass fed beef. So I think the people side of it will always be one of the biggest constraints and take maybe the longest time to solve.
So then moving on, how do you incentivize farmers to switch to producing grass fed beef if that knowledge of production isn't there? And when they see that the conventional system is often more profitable and those inefficiencies are often less encountered, how do you incentivize those small farmers and consumers?
Yeah, well, I think we think that the current market price provides a pretty strong incentive and signal to producers. And if you look at our analysis on the production side, like, we do see not all grass-fed beef producers are making a lot of money, but some are, and they're either doing one of these two things, so selling direct to consumer, small volume, very high prices, or, you know, a larger volume, lower cost of production via branded programs. They're both two very, you know, reasonable and solid business strategies. You know, and the price signals are there. One thing we have heard holding things back a little bit is there does also still seem to be a bit of a disconnect though between the amount of demand in the market and what consumers are saying. And the aspirations of some of the big buyers, those retailers or food service companies, and then the reality on the ground, where we do hear that actually producers can sometimes struggle to actually find a market for their grass-fed beef. So there's something sort of missing there. There's some connecting piece which is missing, because you talk to the big buyers and they say, we'd love to sell more grass-fed beef, we just can't get hold of it in the sort of volume and consistency we need. And then I say the producer is saying, well, we can't always find an easy market. So we do think that supply chain piece is going to be critical for actors, to whether it's branded programs, whether it's cooperative arrangements, whether it's processors, distributors, to kind of really bring some kind of scale and efficiency along the supply chain and connect up that strong price signal with the production side.
And the other thing I would add in terms of incentivizing farmers is, and we actually cover this in our report as well, some farmers actually switched to grass-fed beef because they were just losing money big time by doing conventional cattle. Because when you do conventional cattle, very often you're just heavily tied to grain prices, which is very volatile, fluctuates all the time. Whereas if you can do grass-fed beef well, your feed cost is in a way minimized because you're just growing grass. And so that's very often just a big incentive for farmers to want to say, I've been losing money, it's not working, let me try something else.
So I'd love to get our third panelist, Jill Eisenberger, the CEO of Stone Barns, on this call. Jill, why did Stone Barns decide to get involved with this report?
We're very interested in seeing more regenerative agriculture in kind of a variety of product lines, if you will, and we're intellectually curious about the potential for grass-fed beef, and know a lot of producers who are doing really great ecological stewardship of large landscapes across the country using smart pasture management. And so we were really interested in using the report as a way to deepen the conversation and also to hopefully spur some partnerships. So we had a big conference here last week where we mixed producers, restaurateurs, distributors, processors, just to try to stimulate some conversation that would encourage the kind of partnerships that Paul was talking about.
Jill, can I follow up, please, on that event that was last week at Stone Barn Center? Was there anything that surprised you out of that discussion, the way people took the report or reacted to the aspirational model or any of your findings? Was there anything, even throughout the process of doing this research, anything that surprised you?
Trying to think what the most surprising thing was to me at the meeting. I think what surprised me at the meeting was how honest people were about how difficult and complicated this business is. A lot of times when we gather people, they're people who are already like deeply bought into regenerative agricultural practices, and there's an idealism about their ability to work in the marketplace. And I appreciated the candor that people brought to that meeting about challenges in marketing, challenges in consumer understanding, challenges kind of in the competitive landscape with the conventional producers. So I guess that, just the willingness for people to speak out about the complexity of the situation and not just to say, because we think it's better, it's all going to work or it's all going to be okay. So. But Renee or Paul might have some observations too about things that surprised them in the discussion.
I think one thing that maybe didn't surprise me too much, but in a way it also did, was I think the meat buyers at our event at Stone Barns were very open to admitting that people want grass-fed beef, but there's not enough in the US, and so we go source it from South America. And so that's, in a way, encouraging for U.S. ranchers to know that there is the demand out there. But I think that's when we really need to think about how do we make the supply chain of grass-fed beef in the U.S. more efficient so that consumers can get to it.
For me, there were a couple of things. I mean, there's still quite a lot of, let's say, difference of opinion within the grass-fed beef movement around some fairly fundamental issues, actually. For example, can you do high-quality year-round grass finishing in the USA? And there were certain people in that room saying you can't or you shouldn't try. You're better off, for example, buying from the Northern Hemisphere certain times of year than buying from the Southern Hemisphere other parts of the year. I know there's other people who very strongly believe that that can be achieved, and it is being achieved already. And we have found case studies where it is being achieved. So that was quite an interesting difference of opinion. And then there was a pretty fundamental conversation around taste and quality. So can and should grass-fed beef be produced in such a way that it has all the same characteristics of grain-fed beef in a way, in terms of marbling and tenderness and taste? Is that the goal? Because that's kind of what consumers are used to and what they want. Or should we accept that grass-fed beef will always taste different because they're produced a different way? It'll maybe have a stronger, beefier taste, and may also have variability in taste because there's this idea of terroir, and that the grass of beef will reflect the pastures in which it's produced. And that's a very different kind of a very different kind of a world for consumers, who are used to when they buy a steak every time it's always the same. So again, I don't think there was consensus in the room of what the right strategy was on that. We heard some different views. So I think it's just a reflection of some of the complexities within the sector still, some of the questions are still being debated by very experienced and well-informed participants.
I think this is a great opportunity to switch to a more open conversation among maybe the farmers or ranchers on this call. Based on this report and the findings that Renee and Paul and Jill just outlined, what types of challenges have you faced in grass-fed beef production? And do you have any questions for them on their findings? And please unmute yourself before you speak.
Hi, this is Philip Hodgins. I'm with Oakstone Farms. Thank you all for the great overview. Hopefully everybody could hear me. I own a farm upstate New York, where we operate about 700 acres. And I originally started as a grass-fed farmer, and I actually switched to a pasture-raised, lightly grain-finished, and kind of what I call a low-impact feeding facility. Largely because of the challenges I faced, with the grass-fed market in New York City. And it kind of leads me into my next comment, which Paul brought up about, I guess the willingness or investors looking to get involved in the grass-fed movement. I switched largely because, I found raising grass-fed beef in New York State was difficult. I actually thought it was less beneficial to the animals trying to raise animals during our winters when we were able to basically really not get great gains. And once I found a market that wanted an animal that was raised on grass, lightly grain finished, but was not confined and had unobstructed access, to me, that was a home run. And I was able to, although receive slightly less of a premium, I was able to finish my animals in a period of time that fit the consumer's needs. It fit my market, and I've been able to grow there. And basically, with me operating, not counting leased land, let's call it 700 acres, I could run, basically in a non-confined element. Let's say I can run, 500, around 500 animals a year, and that becomes largely sustainable. The opportunity or the troubles I found when I was raising grass-fed was one, the market. It was very difficult, and number two, it was the amount of land I needed in order to run 500 animals. I would need in excess of 1,000 acres or more, and it takes a lot longer. So the reality is you probably need to be running closer to 1,000 animals or so. So kind of going back to kind of Paul's comment earlier, I think there is tremendous opportunity in the grass-fed space. If in fact, private capital, or private equity were to come to places like New York State, we're blessed with water and we're blessed with grass and we're blessed with New York City. But the issue we have, unlike Australia, is that we are, our land base is very bifurcated. So basically it becomes a logistical challenge of managing, a variety of different farms. And, although you're managing 700 acres, let's call 60% of that is pasture. So, I'd love to, kind of get your thoughts as to, when you're looking at basically investing in an area, what is it you want, what is it you look for in kind of putting together, an investment in, in a place like New York State where, you've got tremendous land, tremendous soils and tremendous grass. You're looking at a more challenges logistically, and then, basically, how do we address the climate impact? I agree. Grass-fed cattle can be raised in the U.S. very efficiently, but, it's expensive. And so I know we talk about what the consumer has to pay. But, from my perspective, the machinery and the investment needed to have the equipment, to manage the land base is high, which is fine if you have the market. And what I found with my, with my pasture raised grain finish program is, I can send, 20, 30 a week easily. And there is that demand in New York City. And for the grass fed market, I'm sending two, I'm sending four. And then all of a sudden, somebody closes shop. And then, I'm holding an animal for 24 or 26 months that I have to then put that animal back into the conventional market. So it's those challenges that, I'd love to hear if, so I guess the bottom line is, we need the buyer. We have the opportunity, but, I think it's, the challenges have been unique. And, ultimately if the consumer wants it, we're going to grow it. And so, I'd love to hear any kind of thoughts about, what you need from capital, and how do we actually affect the market in New York City being so close, and yet we can't seem to hit that market.
Just a couple of reactions. That's a really interesting observation there. I mean, a couple of points. I think, from our point of view as investors looking at this, we've seen some of the issues around, say, New York State. And one of the flip side, being close to a big market, you're often in an area of higher land cost and often more fragmented land as well, so which I think you've alluded to. And it can be a little bit hard for, an acre of land, which is selling for, I don't know what it sells up there, $2,000-$3,000 an acre, just to maybe to bear the economics, of grass-fed beef, if that's all that's being done. One thing we're very interested in is actually looking at stacked enterprises, especially not trying to produce grass-fed beef in isolation, but producing grass-fed beef in integration with other farming systems. For example, we're working at the moment on our organic grains strategy, and we could see a really beneficial role for cattle to come on and graze cover crops or even perennial pastures as part of longer-term rotations, on that land. So in that way, the grazing is actually additive to the returns you'd be getting from the farming, from the grain operation, and therefore you're kind of getting access to land and but having to pay the full cost. So we think it's a great potential there in many parts of the country where that kind of mixed farming system may be the optimal route. I think the other just point about the market, I think we've heard this from a few people, the one thing that could shift things, you had a big buyer, a big retailer or food service company, somebody saying, making a big commitment to grass-fed and almost taking upon themselves to do the hard work, to break through that chicken and egg problem of demand and supply, and working on the market supply chain efficiencies and everything else. And no one's quite there yet. I think there's, if you think what Blue Apron are doing now with their acquisition of BN Ranch, there's a couple of people getting closer to that. I think that could shift things. You get one of those big companies saying, right, we want to differentiate ourselves in the market by going 100% grass-fed beef. Well, then the ripples will be sent through the supply chain fairly quickly.
Well, that's great. I appreciate that. It's interesting because I won't compromise too much of the call, but, if I look at how we manage our cattle, to be honest, I'm indifferent to raising grass-fed cattle or, or grain-finished cattle. It's really what the consumer wants, but how we operate is, effectively what you said. We've rotational grazed. We've received, a lot of grants for, how we move our cattle. We work very closely with the Upper Susquehanna watershed. We use a variety of, of cover cropping techniques, via, the NRCS programs. And for me, it's interesting in New York State because let's be honest, whether you're in New York State or, up and down the coast, you go down south, you have problems with drought, you go up north, you have problems with winter. So in some respects, although our animals are never confined during extreme weather conditions, they're going to be in, let's call it, sacrifice pastures. So, the benefit in some cases has been unique. And this is where, I love the OSP, and maybe, we'll circle back at some stage. But when you do have animals in a semi-confined area and we're trying to move towards, what the market wants. So we do run multiple systems. We run cattle and we also run hogs. And the benefit is basically is manure management. It's liquid gold. We're not confined, so we'll never be perceived as a feedlot. But the idea of having large groups of animals in an area where you can collect manure and then throw that back on the fields, which eliminates the need for synthetic fertilizers, and then and then obviously utilize cover crops to prevent erosion. The systems work, and actually rents in New York State aren't high. They're pretty low. So the system can work, but it's logistics. It doesn't work when you manage 50 head of cattle. And what I've seen on my pasture raised side, what we do is become a market. So you have, 100 different farms raising 50 animals. And so they've got no market for it. They're taking these great animals and they're sending them to the local sale barn. So what we can do is basically you create kind of the same thing you do in the Midwest. So you have, the ability to have a grass-fed finisher and a non-CAMFO element that creates a market. But again, the issue is, how do you team up with a buyer? And this whole, I agree. I mean, they don't raise better grass-fed cattle, in Australia or New Hampshire, or excuse me, New Zealand or South America. It's just a function of how do we get the buyers to focus on, on the U.S. And that's where, any commitment that we can get, as we do these kind of partnerships, I think New York State, needs a chance. You know, there was one large buyer that was buying through Adirondack Razors, which was a grass-fed cooperative. And my understanding is that the buyer pulled away because of a consistent quality. So I think there needs to be an education process and a grace period where, you know, farms can be, you know, taught the right way. And basically, and we can meet expectations, but you know, there's a ton of opportunity upstate New York, just for, you know, I'll leave it at that.
Thanks, Phil. Thanks so much. Obviously this is a US centric, discussion and report, but I'd love to bring in anyone who's on the call, who's not in the US right now, and ask about your experiences, with grass-fed beef production and supply chains internationally. So if anyone who is on the call internationally would love to chime in right now. Okay, what about anyone in other regions besides the New York area?
So this is Russ Conser in Texas. And my question actually is, I don't have anything to represent from the region perspective, but I'm curious, I saw in your report you and was aware you had done this producer survey, if you might be able to distill down any regional differences and perceptions that you judged from that survey that are relevant to how different people see the market and their experience.
Yeah, I think in our producer survey, we had roughly 170 responses coming from producers from all over the country. And I think some of the findings that we learned is maybe it wouldn't surprise you, Russ. Basically, different regions do have their own challenges. I feel like if we look at how producers in Northeast talked and complained about how processing is a problem, an issue for them, the issue is actually much worse in California, for example, right? So so that's really one thing that stands out. And when we look at even just, how producers, how long the animals need to travel to get to the processing units, to processing facilities, you definitely see the regional differences there as well. But then there are definitely a few things that also tie, that's like a common thread among all the producers. And interestingly enough, most of them don't talk so much about production as a challenge for them, but really more the market. And that's from regions all over, producers from all the regions. Market in the sense that some of them says, you know, I sell through a farmer's market, but it's a lot of work and it's really far from where I'm based, so it's very labor intensive. Then there are other things such as demand in my local area is becoming a bit more saturated. So how do I sell farther out to other regions now? So that's another thing. So in a way, which is interesting, because what we find from the market study is we feel, and as Paul mentioned, the demand is there. But yet from a producer's perspective, what they perceive as challenges is actually not so much the production cost, but then how do they actually sell the animals? And I feel like overall, I think the producers in the Midwest probably has it the best compared to the other regions, in the sense that it's the infrastructure is there. It's a bit more concentrated in terms of where the producers are and all that. And I think what's also surprising is multiple producers have told us that despite me being based in an area that has really cold winters, I finish my grass-fed beef year-round. So that's when we know that it's actually possible to do it. One thing that I also personally find interesting is that very few producers actually talked about how they have a quality issue when it comes to beef, even though that's actually really what we hear from a lot of the buyers, is that the quality is really inconsistent. But no producers have told us that, oh yeah, my beef is not good enough. So in a way, I think it's, I wonder if that's something that you encounter when you talk to other producers, you know, how many producers out there would actually admit that, yeah, I think I actually need to work on my quality consistency issue. But that definitely seems to be actually big problems among the meat buyers and the consumers. So, yeah.
I'd love to jump in for a minute, if that's all right. Can everyone see me? Okay, good. So I'm Sam. I'm the CEO of Fleischer's, and I have the privilege of working with Phil. And we have a little full disclosure. We have a little feature in this study that came out. So we are a purchaser. We only buy pasture-raised meat. So we only buy the meat in the top two boxes of that little four square chart. So we buy both pasture-raised, grain finished, and we buy grass-fed, grass-finished. And one of the challenges that I see to getting grass-fed animals to market, and this is part of the scale discussion, it goes hand in hand, is about who owns the whole animal. And the pasture-raised, grain-finished market has been able to kind of tap into the existing market that supports the purchasing of parts and pieces. So you're not, as a buyer, necessarily obligated to buy the whole thing. Historically, we Fleischer's have purchased the whole thing. And when you work with smaller producers, it's a big ask to not take the whole thing, because you're saying, well, I know that as a retailer, I could only move these things, so you're going to have to deal with the rest. Who takes on that burden of moving the basically ground beef is a massive challenge in any beef market. And I think that grass-fed is just a little bit behind where the pasture-raised market is in terms of figuring out uses for grass-fed meat, because it is leaner. It does behave differently. I've had 100% grass-fed beef hot dogs, and they're a different recipe. They just require different handling. So I think it is a different product, and we have to be careful not to lump it in to, in some ways it's the same product, and in some ways it has to be handled differently. And at Fleischer's, we are learning that we actually need to partner more. We've historically been a very vertically integrated company, and we're actually moving more toward a model where we are finding partners who share the same values we do about regenerative systems and pasture-raised animals, and finding people who are really, really good at what they do in the supply chain, and all working together to do our parts to create one really resilient system.
Thanks, Sam. I have a question for you. So you all source primarily from the Hudson Valley, is that correct? Yeah.
It's not in the Hudson River Valley exactly. It's New York State. New York State primarily. We have a little bit of Connecticut and a little bit in the southwest corner of Pennsylvania. Yeah.
Okay. So from your regional perspective, what is the ideal public-private partnership? Obviously, this is a Concordia question. We love public-private partnerships. But what is the ideal public-private partnership to support the future of grass-fed beef production in the Northeast Hudson River Valley region?
Or just to add,
for me,
if there was something that's been working very successfully in the past, specifically on the public sector side, that you want to recognize and say, this is a great program or a great initiative, and to see how we can make sure that positive steps taken in the past several years are continued, really with regards to public-private partnerships in the food and agricultural system.
Sure. So the two big issues or public assistance things that I have seen work really well and that have been beneficial for our entire supply chain. Number one, there are certain farmers, they're usually, farmers who are their second career farmers, they've come to it from something else, who have really figured out how to work the grant system and gotten funding, the funding that's coming in through sustainable agriculture, through development initiatives, who can help them deal with watershed issues. And I think those are the biggest things that we've run into. I mean, I've literally had a conversation with a farmer where I say, your animals are beautiful, they're outdoors, like this is great, we love to buy from you. And he says, well, actually, New York State came to me a few weeks ago and told me I had to pour a concrete slab and put a roof over them because because I have a manure issue and it's going to go into the watershed and I can't raise animals outdoors anymore. And that's the message he's hearing from one branch of the government. Whereas on the other side, there's people actively giving out money so that people are going to be doing more regenerative grazing and keeping their animals outside as opposed to bringing them in. So for me, the outreach to farmers who are reaching, and I guess the irony is that that only happens when he hits scale or he or she hits scale. So you have a farmer who's actually about to make that jump to being a viable business financially. And then he gets shut down in the pasture raised system because he or she isn't doing things, in a way that is conventional. And so I think that's one thing that could really, I have seen the farmers who've been able to tap into that system do big, beautiful pasture raised systems, and it works amazingly. Those who haven't, who for whatever reason don't have the right connections or aren't as savvy about how the bureaucracy works, have a lot more trouble accessing that, and so oftentimes just get turned into conventional farms because they can't figure out a way around the hurdles. And the other thing that I think has been great is the push for institutions to buy, right now it's coming out in this like buy local movement, but I would love to see more like buy pasture raised. And with that though comes some challenges of how you measure and reward institutions for buying in that way. As you pointed out in the report, labeling is still a huge challenge. We don't have really good labels. And so if you incentivize institutions to buy organic meat, well, then you're really excluding most of the Northeast and a lot of pasture-raised farmers and a lot of people without these pretty little labels all over their stuff who are actually doing really good work. So I think there's a challenge of encouraging people to buy pasture-raised meat, regeneratively raised meat, but figuring out a way to qualify people into that system that's not necessarily so tied to these labels, which we've already established may or may not be the best indicator of what the person's doing.
Thanks, Sam. So I'm going to leave. I think we have time for one more question. It's almost 10:30. So if anyone has any final questions, let us know now.
Well, Concordia is always happy to help coordinate connections or otherwise extend a conversation. So if something comes to you today over your grass-fed lunch, please do write it down and let us know. And we are happy to make sure you get the answers you're looking for, the insight you need. Thank you, everyone, for taking the time on a busy Monday morning to have this conversation. We know now is the time to really be talking about some of these regenerative techniques and how to make things more scalable and efficient. So we appreciate everyone chiming in with their perspectives and questions. We're very grateful at Concordia for our speakers, Jill, Renee, and Paul, for the time they took to share this presentation with us today. And we hope that it just really kicks off some good thought around how partnerships and collaboration can lead to a better outcome around this specific area. So thank you, everyone, for taking the time. We will be sending a summary shortly, probably around tomorrow, to all participants, and that will also reside on our website at concordia.net, where we'll have the audio recording to this and other materials that are relevant to this conversation. So it's always findable on the web presence, but just let us know if you have any questions, or we'd love to hear your thoughts and feedback from this as well. We also have a newsletter that we issue on a quarterly basis that includes information around Concordia and specifically the campaign for a sustainable global food supply. So if you'd like to sign up for that, please let us know. And we will just keep in touch and always happy to continue this conversation. Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you.